The time for talking is over.
The match clock showing 4 hours and 12 minutes.
Thibodeau lobs him. And gets
it. Going to have a short for him inside in. Murray, they are running.
Got it! He's got it! What's the smash like? It's good! It's good from Porter!
Sits it back. An ace out wide!
And Arena Sabalenka collapses on Rod Laver Arena.
And it is 10 of the absolute best for Novak Djokovic.
Hi everyone, John Huvenaar's with you on the AO Show, and what a week it's been in the Californian desert. But the tennis doesn't stop, we're already underway in the Magic City. Here's what's coming up. Sky's the limit, the rise and rise of Carlos Alcaraz.
There's highs and lows to this, and it needs to play out over an extended period of time. I think that would be the best thing for this sport.
Iga Swiatek withdraws from her Miami title defense with injury.
There's such a skill in making sure that you schedule right, you have great time to be able to recoup.
And how Elena Rybakina turned the tables on Arina Sabalenka.
Rybakina had thought, well, I'm going to give you a little taste of your own medicine.
That's all ahead on the AO Show. From Indian Wells to Miami, here are the headlines. Carlos Alcaraz returns to world number one after upstaging Daniil Medvedev, ending the Russian's 19-match winning streak. Elena Rybakina flips the script on her Australian Open nemesis Arina Sabalenka to clinch her fourth career title. World number one Iga Swiatek pulls out of her Miami title defence with a rib injury. Bianca Andreescu overcomes Emma Raducanu in a first-round battle of the US Open former champions. And Novak Djokovic expresses mixed emotions about being part of the golden era of men's tennis in his first interview since leaving the scene of his 10th Australian Open triumph. Joining me on the roundtable today are Casey Dellacqua and Todd Woodbridge. And Case, how was your time at Indian Wells?
It was great. It was really great to connect back with the playing group, obviously post-Australian Open, and we chatted a lot of things about AO and United Cup and then looking forward. So it was, as I said, great to connect with the playing group. Always nice to be back in Indian Wells. It's such a beautiful venue, such a beautiful space to play tennis. So, yeah, it was great. Thanks, John. And hi, Todd. How are you?
Case, doing well. I'm a little jealous of you travelling to the desert and seeing all those places.
Hey, you were just in the Maldives. I did see you in the Maldives.
I did have a good break, but, you know, you're never not a player anymore. That's how I feel. And when you start watching the venues that you've got good memories of, you still have this visualization that you can go out and play at that same level. And, you know, in the 50s now, just it's a little slower, that's all.
I thought you were talking about the 1950s for a sec there, Todd. But
no, not that
quickly
far
understand
back,
where
Todd.
We are. Come on. Now, Carlos Alcaraz, most impressive result for him. His seventh title within the space of 13 months, would you believe? And it's hard to see much room for improvement, although you guys are the experts, you tell me.
Yeah, look, I mean, firstly, just quickly, I had a quick read of his essay, I guess in his own words, and it was interesting to hear that, you know, he does work closely with a psychologist for me, and I think, you know, having had that, I guess, the note on him in terms of are you going to follow in the footsteps of Nadal, Djokovic, those kind of, that kind of narrative in his head, I think in terms of him working with a psychologist and how important that is for him, I feel like, Todd, perhaps that's something that he'll have to continue to, you know, work on because his game and physically and that, he's obviously inept. And obviously injury management's also key with a player like Alcaraz. But what do you think, Todd?
Well, I tend to agree with you. The one thing that the team around him have to do is to let him mature as a young adult and how he grows and what life experiences he still has off the court. And that's so important to his development. And then who do you look at to draw upon to say, you know, this is the person I have to emulate? And look, one of the careers or two of the careers in a way I look at is the Williams sisters because of the way they had this incredible longevity about them. And they didn't overplay. They were able to play, you know, obviously late into their 30s. And I think for Carlos, you know, the game wants him to be around for a long time. And right now it's about managing that and not rushing and, you know, not having to have every one of these important results immediately. And I think if he takes that approach, he actually wins more. And I just, you know, I look at him, and it's so impressive to come away from a break and win such a big tournament like that. It's exciting for the game, but let's not pressure him too much in that he's got to do it all in a hurry, and, you know, there's highs and lows to this, and it needs to play out over an extended period of time. I think that would be the best thing for this sport.
And then in the women's, we saw Elena Rybakina flip the script on her Australian Open conqueror in Aryna Sabalenka. It was a very different match from what we saw in Melbourne just 2 months ago, Casey.
It was. It was a different match and obviously a different outcome. And, you know, there's been talk around, is this the next, you know, greatest rivalry that we'll see? And I saw Pam Shriver talk about, you know, the fact that perhaps they need to play a few more matches at Slams. And I probably agree with that, to consider, I guess, a rivalry. We saw, you know, Ash play a number of women at Slams and kind of create that history through Slams. So I think French Open will be really interesting. Both of those players haven't had a huge amount of success at Roland Garros before. So, but they're the two women now that have obviously been the standout performers, along with Iga. Obviously, Iga's have had a great season already as well. But I think, you know, the style of play of those two women, the powerful hitting, you know, who's going to get on the front foot, who's going to execute at crucial times the best, kind of creates that sense of really great rivalry, because it's who can put their best front foot forward in that big moment. And obviously Sabalenka did that. And then she mentioned, we've all talked about how great she's been, you know, psychologically on the court and not getting down when things have got tough. And she said, even in that second set at that match in Indian Wells, that perhaps just creeped in, but she's continuing to learn. So it is an exciting, matchup to look forward to. So we'll see what Roland Garros and kind of through the next lot of slams brings.
Well, twice now we've seen Rybakina triumph over Iga Swiatek this year. Where does that leave the world number one? Some cracks starting to appear, Case.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. The Iga is not, obviously she played a lot post Australian Open and went to the Middle East and played, and she got that infection in Doha, which seems to be a bit of a flow in terms of the rib injury and the cough that she kind of had throughout that Middle East kind of section, and pushing and pushing and pushing. And it's got to a point where it's obvious she needs to have a bit of a rest. And I think that's where it comes to, you know, really scheduling smart, like Todd mentioned about Alcaraz. I think if you're the world number one and you're playing amazing tennis, there's such a skill in making sure that you schedule right, you have great time to be able to recoup and manage. So I feel like I'm not overly surprised that she pulled out of Miami, because she's played a heap of tennis post-AO. But, yeah, it's an interesting one. And I think having, you know, the game style that Iga does, she doesn't have the firepower like a Rybakina. She doesn't have the serve where she just steps up and can hit aces like those bigger hitting players. So she has to find ways to create, you know, blips in her opponent's games, which, you know, it will be really interesting to see how Iga's, this French Open, Wimbledon kind of stint unfolds for her. But, I mean, she's still, in my eyes, you know, one of the biggest threats on the women's game at the moment.
Casey, I think what's important for Iga is, I don't necessarily think there are cracks in her game. I think there are still parts of her game that have to improve. And that will be the test for her, is continually adding to the repertoire. We know that Ash Barty gave her trouble with slice backhand, so she's got to be able to work on that shot. She has to keep working on the volleying skills and how to transition and utilize that. I've actually crossed over men's and women's tennis a bit today, because I think, you know, her mentor, if you like, in a way that she talks about, is Nadal, and watching how he progressed with his development as a player, how the return got better where he could stand up in the court, how he finishes so well at net. That's what's really important for Swiatek. It's about, she's got to number one with what she's got, and if she wants to retain that and continue to dominate and win multiple majors moving forward, it's about adding to her repertoire, because she's going to have to negate the power of the likes of Rybakina and Sabalenka.
Well, the absence of Swiatek leaves another big opportunity for Rybakina, who is in that quarter of the draw that would have been occupied by the world number one. So let's have a look at the Miami draws. I know the tournament's already underway. And Casey, we've already seen the elimination of Emma Raducanu in the first day of play in the battle of the US Open finalists, Bianca Andreescu prevailing in that one. But who do you see as the other contenders beyond the two big hitters that we've mentioned?
Yeah, well, I guess just on that match particularly, I mean, the likeness of careers between Andreescu and Raducanu is fascinating, isn't it, in terms of winning the US Open on debut for the both of the women, you know, similar ages, you know, in and out of the game with injuries post their first major title. So that was an interesting first round matchup for me. But Andreescu, you know, played well in the early stages of that third set to come through the victor in that match. But, you know, Petra Kvitova, a bit of an older, you know, statesman in terms of age, played some great tennis in Indian Wells, always by just at some point in the tournament, always kind of throws in a match, but always a consistent performer. Obviously, Sabalenka's there, still pushing, and Rybakina's obviously probably the favourite to come through there as well.
Well, I really love the fact that for the moment we've got these contenders coming. And, you know, 6 months ago we thought, oh, well, it's really unpredictable in the women's game. Well, I think the pool has tightened and we can look at the semis and go, more than likely we're going to have these four in there. I actually love the fact I think Sabalenka can bounce back quite quickly as long as she gets a couple of days off, gets going again. I think for me, she's this real dark horse of this whole year, as I've mentioned a little earlier, and I really like her run going into this tournament. We did touch on the Raducanu-Andreescu. Can I just make a point on Raducanu? The patience that she's showing, I think, is really good and really important. We saw a picture between the two different bodies of a year ago to this year and the development of an athlete, and that's exactly what she has had to do. She is building a stronger, robust adult body. You've got to remember she won the US Open as a teenager, still basically a junior. And so she's starting to do the work off the court that I think in time, with patience, she'll get there to that top 10 ranking again and then be able to contend. As long as she remains, you know, pressureless, if you like, in her mind and doesn't have too many outsiders putting that pressure on her, then I think we're going to see her grow as a player. I thought that was really good to see.
Well, Medvedev was trying to win four consecutive titles last week, but that run came to an end at the hands of Carlos Alcaraz, who would appear to be the favourite again at Miami.
Well, he is. I think for him it's about, does he recover? Because he had that time away, and no matter how much training that you do, match play can really start to deplete you quickly if you haven't had it for a while. And I actually think on the men's side, I think it's harder for him to go back to back. I think it opens up again for somebody like Medvedev to have another great week. I think the loss for Medvedev actually is important. It's weird. I have this strange feeling sometimes about you want to get a loss out of the way to get the wins at the bigger thing at the time. So we stop, you know, us in the media stop talking about match wins and all of that. He's just primed to continue. This is his last hard court tournament, remember, and that will be important for him. He doesn't, as we know, like the clay too much. So one more big win here, I think is going to be important for him, and he'll be gunning for that.
Yeah, and good to see a few Aussies over there still, you know, playing some good form. Thanasi Kokkinakis obviously has got in as a lucky loser, which is great. Popperin got through his first round, even though it came in a retirement. But, you know, Alex de Minaur still looking to, you know, push his way through these type of events into the latter stages. Jason Kubler. So lots of Aussies out in action. Christopher O'Connell also got through as a lucky loser as well. So lots of Aussies in action in Miami in the men's draw as well.
Someone who isn't there is Novak Djokovic, who has spoken for the first time since his 10th Australian Open title this week. He has no regrets that he's missed Indian Wells and Miami, but interestingly has been asked about and commented on what he thinks about being part of the golden era of men's tennis. And his initial response was that he was slightly annoyed. That's me paraphrasing. Annoyed to have been a part of this golden era with Nadal and Federer. But he also says that conversely, it's made him a better player.
Well, I think it's the perfect summary. I mean, I would agree with him. You wouldn't want to have been in that era when you know you're a great player and you're battling to win majors, but these other guys kept winning them on you. But without doubt, each one of these has pushed each other to a height that I don't think I thought we would ever see. The quality of tennis that they produced, the longevity is the most important thing, because three of them have played longer than basically any other major champion has ever played, that has pushed each other along. So, you know, Novak, in a way, I think has been lucky. When he talks about missing Indian Wells and Miami because of the vaccination, you know, this is another piece for him that I think has extended his career. He's actually had a chance to have a forced break, not through injury, which has allowed him to refresh. It's allowed him to go away and work on his physical side of things, his mental. He's had time with his family. And you cannot say how important that is, to be able to have spent time with your children. And it makes you feel comfortable, because when you're in a situation as a parent and you're away a lot, you start to worry about that, and that can affect your performance. So, you know, I think Novak has used this piece of time incredibly well. And as he said, he looks back with no regrets, because he's still so much focused on the future and what is available for him to still achieve. And I really tip my hat to him for that.
Yeah, look, I tend to agree with Todd in terms of that forced break. It's very hard to want to skip big events like Indian Wells and Miami. They're on the calendar. They're two of, you know, the biggest events outside the slams. But when you're kind of forced into that situation, then you take some positives, and Novak's very good at, you know, looking at the future, as he always talks about, and just taking what's in front of him really well. So I think, yeah, I think the time that he's got at home, the time he has to mentally just refresh, I think, you know, the form that we saw him play at the Australian Open was just incredible. So I think, you know, going into the French and Wimbledon and kind of that season, he's going to be extremely tough to beat.
Only three times in history have the Australian Open women's finalists met again in the final of Indian Wells in the same year. In 2000, Lindsay Davenport beat Martina Hingis in both finals. In 2012, Victoria Azarenka did the same to Maria Sharapova. But this week, Australian Open runner-up Elena Rybakina vanquished her conqueror Aryna Sabalenka in the corresponding Indian Wells final in straight sets. Today, we're going to unpack how she did that by comparing the two finals through the lenses of strategy, emotion, and execution. To do that, I'm joined by AusOpen.com's Matt Trollope and analyst Simon Ray from the Game Insight Group. Welcome, guys.
Yeah, hi, John. Hi, Matt. Good to be with you guys. Thanks for the opportunity to get together again and talk about these two superb female athletes that are absolutely at the top of their game right now and are really stamping themselves as looking to hunt down Iga Swiatek, and remarkable performances from both of them to start the 2023 campaign.
Mm. I was really interested listening to your chat, the two of you on the podcast a few weeks ago, where you talked about both Sabalenka and Rybakina. They have similar weapons. They're both high up on, you know, among the women in terms of serve speed, forehand heaviness, backhand heaviness. And you basically said there's really nowhere to go against either of them, and it's overwhelming. You're faced with a barrage. So as someone that's coached at a high level before, Simon, like, what would you tell your player? Where do you go? What weakness do you try to target when that kind of onslaught is coming at you across the net?
I think it's a great question, and it's not easily answered, Matt. So you really put me on the hot seat there. I think, you know, trying to identify any type of weakness in these two outstanding athletes at the moment is easier said than done. And one thing to come up with a plan, another thing entirely altogether to be able to execute that plan under pressure and to get the job done. Sabalenka, in the first set of the AO final, making contact with that second serve return inside the baseline 38% of the time in set one. Set two, though, stand by, get ready for this number, 83%. Okay. So it's gone from 38 to 83 to 80 in the final set. Rybakina, by contrast, 57. She stays high in set two, 78, and she's right down in set three, 36. So in my mind, it's that notion of the steam train gathering momentum. Sabalenka, you know, she loses the first set, and in her mind, she's going, look, I might go down here today, but if I do, I'm not going to die wondering. I'm going to go down on my terms. I'm going to take the fight to my opponent. And I think when Sabalenka is at her best, to answer your question, there's no really easily identifiable weaknesses. One thing that does come to mind, if you can put these two women on defense, if you can find a way to get them behind in the point, sure, perhaps you can expose them. But good luck doing that, given the heat that they're bringing on serve and the intent that I've mentioned that both of them are bringing from a returner serve perspective. So you can do that through playing first strike tennis. Perhaps if you're an Ash Barty and you're gloriously talented with a sublime skill set, you can do that through the use of a slice backhand and changing gears and being a little more nuanced in your approach. But hey, the world of women's tennis at the moment, that they don't have any answers for what these two are bringing. And so they're stamping themselves as contenders for Grand Slams in the short and medium term, in my mind.
If we leap forward to Indian Wells, I think a lot of people thought maybe the answer to that question when Rybakina came up against world number one Iga Swiatek, that was another Australian Open rematch. We saw Rybakina beat her in the fourth round. They came up in the semifinals. People thought maybe the slower court, Iga was playing better. She could get Rybakina on the move. You said she was not as good defensively, but we saw Rybakina beat Iga 6-2, 6-2, wiped her off the court. And so then that set up this Sabalenka-Rybakina rematch, which is only the third time that's happened ever at Indian Wells in a women's final. But this time the result was different. So when you were saying all those things about Sabalenka, like, you know, there is no weakness, doesn't want to die wondering, really amped up the aggression when she was a set down, she found herself in the same position in this Indian Wells final, but didn't win. So what maybe did Rybakina do differently that turned this rivalry on its head?
Yeah, well, I think that's a great question. And I think one of the real strengths of the Rybakina game, perhaps in comparison to Sabalenka, I suspect Sabalenka at her very, very best may have a marginally higher ceiling than Rybakina right now. But I like that notion of Rybakina's repeatability and consistency of performance. And you can even see that in the two athletes out on court, which kind of leads us into one of John's themes for the day in terms of mentality or emotionally being able to handle the ups and downs and the topsy-turvy nature of the contest. So we were chatting before we started to record about Sabalenka, I think, coughed up 17 double faults back in that Australian Open final. And we were all kind of surprised to think back at that number being so high. But 10 in the first set of this Indian Wells final is a bit of a different ballgame altogether. And it was certainly a different ballgame in terms of how she handled that emotionally. And you saw, I think, quite a rocked Aryna Sabalenka come out early stages of set two, unable to perhaps park that emotional baggage. Now, how much of that is due to the Rybakina game and no easily identifiable or recognizable weaknesses? I think plenty of it. And Rybakina, again, despite the differing conditions in Indian Wells, a lot more lively and the ball's jumping off the court, she's rock solid, and I reckon she'd made more of a plan or more of an intent to, hey, look, I'm going to return aggressively in this match, and Aryna, you're not going to push me back this time, so you might be coming at me. It's going to take, come hell or high water, I'm not moving back off the baseline on second serve return this time. So, and what we saw was that real consistency of performance from her. 67% of her second serve return points won in set one, Rybakina. 67% of her second serve return points won in set two. So
real there was no drop off. There wasn't a change. She maintained her returning prowess, I guess, throughout the match, which didn't quite happen.
It was 31% less than that in the second set of the AO final, yes. At 36%.
Yeah. I think there was a really steely resolve in the eyes of Rybakina in this match. We spoke about Sabalenka's want to play it on her terms in the AO in sets two and three, no matter the result, no matter the outcome. And I think Rybakina had almost learned that lesson from the opponent in the AO final and thought, well, I'm going to give you a little taste of your own medicine. I'm not going to change today, so I'm going to continue to dominate your second serve, and I'm going to continue to send a message that I'm coming after that, and I'm going to continue to be rock solid off both wings from the back of the court. And we know Aryna's a little more volatile. We know Aryna's capable of throwing in some more double faults. And by contrast, Rybakina, rock solid emotionally, rock solid tactically throughout the contest. And I think that was the decisive factor for me, is almost that competitive mindset, sure, but the ability to maintain that competitive discipline and that steely resolve throughout the contest. There was no fluctuation from Elena Rybakina in the final at Indian Wells.
And I think one under-discussed element of this is Rybakina's serve. We talk about Sabalenka's serve, how on it is or how off it is with the double faults, but Rybakina was the premier server at the AO. She had the fastest speed. She only had two double faults in the Indian Wells final. Maybe there's a perceived pressure there for Sabalenka that if my opponent, Rybakina, is holding serve more comfortably and is more stable, there's more pressure on her serve, even for getting the return.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And the numbers would bear that out. So, you know, set one of the AO final, where obviously Elena Rybakina is the victor in set one, 75% of the second serve points won from the Rybakina racket.
Yep.
In set two, that plunges. She's down at 44%. And in set three,
dips down even further again, if you can believe that, down to 29. Mm. Now, her numbers are not super high or astronomical at Indian Wells, but they're certainly higher than Arena's by comparison. Okay. So 57% in set one of the second serve, points one off the racket of Rybakina, 44% one in set two. So whilst there's a dip there, there's not plunge off the cliff. Yeah. Mm. So that notion of the steam train of Sabalenka gathering momentum in the AO, it was like, well, the steam train came up against the immovable object this time, and Rybakina wasn't going anywhere. Mm.
Adding to those differences was the fact that they have played a tiebreak in the first set of the Indian Wells final, and it went to 13-11, something we didn't get anywhere near in the AO final. From an emotional perspective, how did you rate or analyse Sabalenka and Rybakina?
I watched it. It was incredibly tense because the quality was really, really great. But then I feel that Sabalenka's second serve deserted her, well, her serve deserted her in the tiebreak, and a lot more double faults came, and they came on crucial points. But I don't, even though maybe that technically is not the highest quality, it was still incredibly compelling. And the tennis that had gotten us to that point was excellent. It actually was a real continuation of the AO final, I thought, and that's why everyone was so excited to see them play again. But yeah, it really felt like the kind of a little bit of those yips that had plagued Sabalenka in 2022, shades of that returned. Her reactions were interesting to them. She laughed after a couple of them, which I thought is quite a good sign that she's able to stay at least a little bit relaxed.
But we saw a little bit of that in Melbourne.
But the players traded a lot of set points. I think they might have had three or four each. But to me, watching it, it just felt like Rybakina was going to win it. Every time Sabalenka stepped up for a first serve, and you could hear it in the crowd as well. There was that murmur when she missed a first serve. I was less confident in her second serve in this match than I was in the Australian Open match, and Rybakina probably felt that too, and she scraped through it. I think that was illustrative of what was going on.
I think it's a great pickup and a point really well made. And, you know, you've both identified that notion of almost smiling after the double faults, which I personally quite like, that notion of, you know, you're sooner to laugh at something than cry about it under pressure. And I think that's her coping mechanism, if you like. But what was concerning in a couple of those moments, there was a really stark difference for me, again, in terms of her approach at the Australian Open versus what I saw in the desert there in California. Really, if you're going to live by the sword, die by the sword, in the way she did down here in Melbourne in that final, and what an outstanding performance, and I think she's received the plaudits she rightly deserves from it. But then the sword got put right away in Indian Wells in that first set tiebreak. It was nowhere to be seen.
Back in the scabbard.
Exactly. And I think it was a couple of those double faults were actually made with a real lack of intent or lack of purpose. And those are the ones that are halfway up the net without the type of acceleration or purpose or intent on the ball that we did see from her down here in Melbourne. So I guess what I'm trying to say is there's double faults and then there's double faults. And those ones that I saw in Indian Wells in the first set tiebreak are the type of double faults that you really don't want to be coughing up under pressure.
And I think she did, yes. I think she referenced that in her post-match press conference, which at least shows that she's aware of it, has done all the biomechanical work on the serve, which got it to a better place in the first place.
Yes.
So at least she's definitely got somewhere to go from there and a technical change she can make.
Revert back to plan A.
Yeah.
We have now, over the past few months, seen the emergence of a brand new rivalry in women's tennis that few would have seen coming before the summer. Iga Swiatek is still obviously there right at the top and made it through to the semifinals. But how significant is it for tennis to have two power hitters who've worked their way to a major final and now a sort of a big event, one of the bigger events on the tour within the space of 2 months?
It's super significant because that's the thing that women's tennis has been missing for a long time. There is incredible quality on the tour. All of the ingredients are there to make the game great, but the one thing that's been missing is they've either never been healthy at the same time or a few of them lose early, so you never get them meeting, playing each other consistently in the biggest matches at the end of the biggest tournaments, and that's what's happened here. The two biggest finals of the year have been contested by the same two players. A story can come from that, and people look forward to the next edition of the match because they enjoyed the previous one so much. So everyone was very excited about this. The other thing that's great about those two is that as dominant as Swiatek's been, she's wary of Sabalenka and Rybakina. They can trouble her. We've seen that already. Their power robs Iga of a lot of her weapons. So it's for anyone that says one player dominating all the time is boring, well, that's not happening on the women's tour because Iga might still be winning the bulk of matches, but she's not a lay down mazare to win every match, particularly if they're still there. So now you've got them. They're the top three in the race. They're meeting consistently at the biggest tournaments, and it's really interesting to see how they grapple with each other, and it's the consistency we've been missing. We're seeing that now pretty much ever since Rybakina won Wimbledon and then Sabalenka started recovering kind of towards the back end of that season. They've really been in the conversation now for more than 6 months. So if that can continue, that'll get people invested. I certainly love watching that.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. And I think it's Matt's illustrated it and talked to it really well. I think it highlights a real story to watch. Again, if we hark back 12 months, Swiatek was absolutely and totally dominant and kind of in the midst of that or at the start of that phenomenal run. And I think it speaks to that notion of continuous improvement at the very top of the sport and how important it is. And what we've seen here in Sabalenka and Rybakina is that notion of they've gotten better over the last 12 months. And they've, you know, if not totally bridged the gap, they've certainly narrowed it. And in certain circumstances, well, it was dominant the other day, wasn't it, Rybakina over Swiatek? So now the ball's back in Iga's court, if you like. She's got to go away and recover some of that momentum. And we were used to, across the course of 2022, Swiatek's defense getting it done against these type of ball strikers and this type of weaponry coming at her, but not at the moment. So I think there's a watch on it for sure with the remainder of 2023 in mind.
That's all for this week's episode of The AO Show. Join me again next week for the latest tennis news, views and interviews. Before we go, happy birthday this week to a trio of Australian Open champions, Bethany Mattek-Sands, Stan Wawrinka and Jennifer Capriati. If you've got a question or comment, you can contact me via ozopen.com/listen or email theaoshow@tennis.com.au. Take a moment to subscribe to never miss an episode. And if you're enjoying our content, please consider leaving a rating and review so more fans can discover The AO Show.